All right, good morning to all. We're just about to start in a few moments today's class. King Solomon's book, Ecclesiastes. The last 2 weeks, I believe we took up from Chumash. We'll go back to Kehelis today, and we'll continue. Okay, Jay Jess, nice to see you. Thanks for the audio confirmation. Again, we'll start just momentarily. We'll be picking up from chapter 2, verse 3. Previous classes on Kohelis, they are on the audio page on the site. You can feel free to take a look there and catch up if you missed any of those. Okay, Helen Esther, thanks for the audio confirmation. And Rivka and Muncie, thank you. All right, so we'll just start in chapter 2 in Kohelis. And we're up to verse 3. And again, with the chapters, we don't really pay attention to in terms of Torah study. That's just reference point. Those are created by the Gentiles, just so they can debate with us and have some sort of reference point on the verses. The verses themselves, though, are part of our tradition. So that means each verse is set up by the prophets. Because each verse has a distinct message. Okay. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Good. Cal, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Josh is with us, too.
Hey, Josh. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I'm a little bit of a cold, but I'm doing all right.
I hope you feel better soon.
Thanks. Rabbi, do you know the status of the young man who you sent out the flyer about?
Yeah, they actually I posted on there that they reached the goal, and they're going to start the therapy right away. It's a 5-month long procedure, and Sloan Kettering says that they feel it's a 50% chance, which is very good.
Wow.
So, you know, nice work, you and Josh and Cal, on those very generous donations that you made. And they were very happy. They really expressed a lot of gratitude.
I think I can only imagine what it would be like to be holding your son and, you know, facing a situation like that. So,
And they've gone
able to help. That's great news. Thank you. I haven't been out to the site yet.
Yeah, they actually emailed and let us know that we should stop raising funds because they didn't want to take more than what they had required.
Well, I think that they're just starting their long haul, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah, the flyer mentioned the word retainer, which I assumed meant that there was a lot more expense to come.
I hope not. But again, I think that other people actually emailed in with other resources that assist people in the situation financially, certain insurance, or cancer foundations. So I forwarded that. There were two emails that came in, so I forwarded that to them. So I guess it's a learning process for them, too, in terms of where they can get the funding.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So hopefully whatever else is needed at this point, they'll be able to obtain that.
All right.
You got to try and...
Good morning. Is this Marshall?
Yes.
Hey, good morning. This is Pamela Gentile. I'm Naomi and Shia's friend down in Phoenix.
Yes, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good, good.
I think Naomi's going to be joining us in just a minute as well.
Oh,
so
very good, yeah. Good.
What is the class on this morning?
Well, I was just about to ask if everybody had read the Jewish Times this past week.
We were going to, but then they had company over, so Shia made him put, Shia made Naomi put it away.
Well, I was
like, put that away, you know. Little Yeshua started grabbing at it and destroying it. She's like, all right, just put it away.
Because the Shia had a very good question. I don't want to say it twice. I realized last week I may have done some, the subject matter may have been something that other people read, so I don't want to burden people out of hearing something a second time. So I want to first preface it by asking if Doug, Cal, Josh, if you had read the Times this week, I'll take up something and we'll go to Kahelis. If not, I can address something in the Times.
No, we have not read it here.
Okay. Josh?
I'd read it, but yeah.
All right. You tell me what your option is. We can do Kahelis. We can take a further point on what we discussed last week because there was a question on it. We could do something on the ladder. That was also in the Jewish Times, the dream of the ladder. Or we could do Kahelis. I'll leave it up to everybody. This is a democracy here.
Okay, President-elect Obama.
Josh, do you mind going over the ideas again in the Jewish Times?
No, that's fine with me.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, this will address, is Naomi there?
Well, so I think she's getting the baby ready, so be with us in just a minute.
Well, ask her to get Shia, because this is actually Shia's question.
Oh, okay.
So why don't I wait a minute and see if he can attend. But tell him not to make
Some
me
of
look,
them.
Tell him not to make me look bad by asking another question today.
What time is it out there?
Here it's 11:20 in New York.
Okay, so it's a 2-hour difference, okay.
Oh, you're not there with them. They're at their house, you mean?
Oh, I'm at my house, yeah. Oh,
okay. All right, so we'll start. I don't want to hold up.
I'm not in a hurry, so whenever you guys are ready.
Right.
Well, I'm only going to go on mute because I've only done one other course like this.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, the question is Shia had, because we were talking last week about, I just found that, you know, it's amazing how you could be learning for a number of years. And I remember when I first started learning, you know, and I remember like maybe 5 years into it, you reach a new point where you start seeing things in a whole different light, meaning you advance to like another stage. And it doesn't happen often, but I remember it happening, and 20 years ago, somewhere around then. And just in the past 2 weeks, you know, I sat down with the Chumash, and I'm looking through, and I'm keeping the words in my head. But Rabbi Chait had mentioned that, you know, let the words talk to you. He was talking about the Torah verses. And his instruction was just let the words speak to you. And that just stayed in my mind. I never forgot that. So I was looking through, you know, the parsha last week regarding Rivka and the troublesome birth and, you know, what all the different points were over there. And that she went to the prophet to get information. And why did she have a troublesome birth? And why does she have to have a prophecy about this? I mean, evidently, God was behind this entire event, and evidently, the verses written in the Torah are for all generations. So God is telling us that every single verse here about this account, and every account, each verse is to tell you something new, a profound new point. So I kept that, in more than in the past, very much in the forefront of my thinking, and I was going through last week's, you know, portion, the Torah portion. So we saw that there was just tremendous insight into you know, where Rivka came up with, that Rebecca came up with this idea about stealing the birthright and not approaching Isaac directly, and how Jacob did not disagree at all in terms of lying to his father, but he just said, how are we going to do it? His concern was not, you know, whether or not we should lie. He agreed with his mother. And she actually, according to Uncle's, had into prophecy, but we saw clearly that she had to have, she did get a prophecy, and that prophecy she never gave over to Isaac. And she knew that her younger was going to be superior than the older, which was, you know, typically not the case. Typically, the older one gets a double portion in terms of the birthright. It's a Jewish concept. But then she was told that the older is going to be subservient to the younger. So we mentioned that, well, you know, whenever you get information so from God, there's no imperative to bring that about, necessarily. God is just informing you. Like when he tells Abraham that your children are going to be in servitude 400 years. That did not create any type of an obligation on Abraham to do something to initiate that. Do you follow? It's just, it's sometimes just information. Or when Daniel gets the prophecies about the future, God's not telling him to do anything. God's giving him information. So we asked, so why did where did Rivka get the idea that she had to step in and steal this birthright? So he said that was the second part, where the Torah tells you that as she actually gave birth, so Jacob's hand, who was coming out second, and he was, that means he was the younger, so his hand was clutching onto the heel of Esav. So if the Torah is telling us that, that must be essential. So what I had proposed is that that's a physical act different than the prophetic information that she received from, you know, the prophet, that the older would serve the younger was what she received prophetically. So what was there must be a need for this event in terms of that the hand of Jacob clutching onto the heel. And we know that's how you topple a person over, is you take him by the foot and you grab him by the heel. And Cal had mentioned, you know, last week about do we see that the heel being used in other places? And we see, yes, we see that the regarding the snake and Adam, that God had told the snake that man will succeed over you by crushing your head, but you, the snake, you'll succeed over man by biting him in the heel. And we reference that to mean that that's the heel always means like that's where you'll get the person. And also, you know, there was a metaphor as well that we mentioned. So Rivka had taken that information as being an imperative that now she has to act, because she didn't just receive a prophecy that the older would serve the younger, that Esav would serve Jacob, but she also saw this separate action, and in this she said this must be significant too. And since this is taking place in the physical world, that's an imperative for me to act in the physical world. I mean, I'm getting this information about the ability of Jacob to grab onto his brother, that's telling me something about his nature. God wants me to now know that I can use that information in terms of bringing about the prophecy. So you see what a high-level thinker Rivka was. So she understood the difference between a prophecy that was received metaphysically and information that was given to her in the physical world. And she understood matters of the physical world means that's an imperative, that there's something more here. I'm not just supposed to know about this, but just as the physical world is something that I live in and we act in, so now this is, she understood this as a message that she should now work with that information about Jacob having that ability to overtake his brother. So that's why she had planned this, and that's why we also said that when Esav came back that one day and he was completely exhausted, and he tells his brother, give me some of that red lentils that you made. So immediately Jacob responds and says, you know, I'll give it to you. You sell me your birthright, then I'll give you the lentils. So he was, it seemed to be too, it was premeditated that he was able to have that response on the tip of his tongue. So what I suggested based on that information, like why do we care about this dialogue that Ace was tired, and that, I mean, it is important that we know that he buys the birthright, but the fact that we see this so quickly, that Jacob is so readily able to respond this way, indicates that it was premeditated. And therefore I deduced from there that Rivka had to have told him to always have this in the back of your mind, to buy this birthright, because prophecy told her that he is going to be superior. But he couldn't just be superior and take the birthright. He has to purchase it. It has to be an honest, outright purchase. That's why Jacob was ready at that point. So that verse is not just telling you that he did the right thing and he purchased it properly, but it's also telling you that it was premeditated. He knew this long time ago from his mother, that she confided in him, that she never told Isaac about the fact that of her prophecy. And the proof that she never told Isaac is because, like I think Josh said last week, that even later on, Isaac was ready to give the birthright to Esav. That proves that he was never informed that it should really go to Jacob. So that means Rivka kept it secret this whole time. So, and we said Rivka understood that that Isaac really wasn't as in tune as she was in terms of the children. So therefore, she worked it out this way. She knew that she had to work it this way. All right? That's clear so far.
Yeah, I think we're good.
Okay, so Cheyenne's question was as follows. So it was a very, very powerful question. So he asked me, we were talking this week, you know, on the phone, and this is Rabbi Mann's son. So you know what we're talking about. So he says to me, listen, you know, I understand after the fact that Rivka has the children, and she sees how Isaac favors Esav. I mean, again, the Torah is telling you that Isaac loved Esav, and Rivka loved Jacob. Again, why are we being told this? Again, that's an important thing. It's not just giving you a background story here. It's telling you another piece of information. So, we said that it's to show you how once Rivka understood that God was favoring Jacob, so therefore she favored Jacob. So it's giving you an explanation as to how she was following through on the information of the prophecy. But this again, Shai said, this is only after they had the children that Rivka can make a determination that in terms of the children, that Isaac is not really as in tune as I am, so therefore I will work out my own plan. So that makes sense, that she can see that there's an imbalance in terms of how Isaac is relating to the children, and she really understood it better. So there's nothing she really do. She had to work out a plan where God's chosen would get the birthright. So Shia asked, that's very good after they had the children. But when she was yet pregnant, there were no children yet. So why did she not go to Isaac and inquire of him about the prophecy? So that was Shia's question. I understand that Rivka saw certain things in terms of how Isaac related to the children once they were born and they were growing. So there she's justified in having a plan. And he would grant me that much. But until that point, so why did she only go to either Shem, Noah's son, or to the other commentary said that she went to Abraham? Those are the two prophets available to her at the time. So clearly she never went to Isaac. And Isaac never knew about the prophecies, which proves that point. So why didn't she think to go to her own husband about it? If she saw that the pregnancy was unnatural, and all the women who had children, Ibn Ezra says, she approached them. And she says, is this type of pregnancy normal? And they all told her no. So once she understood that, and she understood that she was part of the lineage of setting up God's nation, so she knew that this was now had to do with God's plan. So that's why she went to inquire from a prophet as to what God had planned. But there was no reason, seemingly, that she should avoid Isaac. Why? That's her own husband. He's a prophet. Let her go to him and ask her own husband what's going on. So that was Shia's question is, so she should have gone to Isaac. There was no reason to omit Isaac from the information yet. I mean, there was no reason to omit Isaac because there was no display by Isaac yet about favoring the wrong child because they didn't have the children yet. You see the question?
Yeah, it's a very good question.
Right. All right, Josh, you got it? Cal?
Yeah.
All right. Pamela, you got it? Hello? All right.
Pamela, you're on mute.
Okay, I'm not on mute anymore.
Okay.
Well, I guess my thought on it is that I'm a girl that was in, 2008, but my thought on it is that if it was natural for the firstborn to have natural birthrights, and she knew that there was something different about it, and if she was still pregnant, if she had a feeling that there might be harm to the baby before they're even born, then maybe she felt it was in the best interest of the children not to say anything, because, now it's pretty prevalent to have abortions, and I don't know anything about how laws were back then, but if there was a way that Isaac would have been upset and not accepting of this to harm the children before they were born, then maybe she felt like waiting until they were born and grown where it would be more of a sin to hurt the babies. So she decided not to say anything for the baby's sake.
Why would she not say anything to Isaac? I'm not following. I mean, she had to get information from, what was the difference between Isaac or Abraham or Shem? Why would she avoid going to Isaac?
Because maybe she felt the health of the children was going to take priority over information given to her husband.
Health? I'm not sure. So what, I mean, as a prophet, I don't think he wouldn't say anything different in terms of, I mean, Abraham or Shem, these were perfected people. They would all share the same philosophy, regardless of whether they were their own children or not.
Well, maybe it was something where she didn't feel like the children would have been grown up the way that they did if anything would have been given prior, if the information would have been given prior.
Well, if it was prophecy, it was coming from God, so it wasn't really an issue of what the information would be, because the prophecy would be from God. It was just Isaac who was saying it or Abraham who was saying it. They would just be verbalizing it, but the content would be the same. If it's prophecy,
okay.
Right, it's coming from God. So the question remains, why did she avoid? What information can we get from this? So that was Shia's question. So what I did was I went back to the verses, and I realized that we really didn't explain the first two verses in that very parsha. So if you take a look, it's right in the beginning of Parsha Toldos. And it says two verses that you'll tell me what the problems are. And Josh, since you read this already, don't tell anybody, right? All right. So it says in the beginning of Toldos, that is Genesis 25:19. If you want to open it up. 25:19. So it says, these are the generations of Isaac, the son of Abraham. All right. You're opening up a new parsha, a new Torah section, so you want to introduce what the topic is. That makes sense. But the next part of that verse says, Abraham bore Isaac. Okay, what's the problem there?
Well, he didn't do it.
Okay, that's one problem.
Sarah did it.
Right.
Sarah's not mentioned.
Okay. But what's the surface information would seem to indicate that what is the plain information that's trying to be imparted to us over here?
Well, I mean, it's saying these are the offspring of Isaac, son of Abraham. So why would it start with Abraham begot Isaac? Why wouldn't you just start with Isaac had, you know, this person, this person, this person?
Right. More than that, isn't it repetitive? It seems to be the second half of the verse is telling me what the first half. The first half told me that these are generations of Isaac, who was the son of Abraham. So why do you have to tell me that Abraham was now the father of Isaac? I know that. That's what you just told me.
Yeah, very good question.
All right? So that seems a little bit, it seems redundant. And also your question, what do you mean, hold it? The man doesn't give birth, the woman does. Right, so that was one question. Look at the next verse. And it was that Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rivka, the daughter of Bethuel, that was her father's name, for Arami. And you could translate that as being a nationality. He was an Aramean. Padan Aram, from the town called Padan Aram. And she was also Achaz Lovin, the sister of Lovin, the Aramean. Again, it says Aramean. All right, so he took this woman for his wife. And it's describing who she is. She's the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, the sister of Lavan, the Aramean. What's the question?
Why is it telling us all this?
Okay.
If the opening is saying these are the offspring of Isaac, okay, you could say he has his wife Rebecca, but now you're giving like her lineage. And a little bit about history, and why do we care whether he was 40 years old, and...
Right. What's redundant in the verse? What is completely unnecessary?
at the very end of my translation, if I cut out the middle part, says Isaac took Rebekah as a wife for himself. Wife for himself seems redundant. Why doesn't it just say as a wife?
Right. What else?
Could be that it's saying that Rebekah is the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean, and then it says sister of Laban the Aramean. Well, if he's her brother, how would he not be Aramean?
Exactly. That seems to be the glaring problem. You want to give me some background? Fine. I mean, there's more in the verse, of course, like you said, the other questions. But that just, you know, stuck out. If you're telling me that her father is Aramean, so of course her brother, he came from his father.
I don't know if that's country or racial or whatever, but does lineage in those days go through the man, or is it possible that Bethuel could have had several wives, one of whom wasn't Aramean, and therefore the son would be considered not Aramean?
I know that. I would say the redundancy is something to pay attention to, because it's not really giving you information otherwise regarding that, what the nature of the city was. Like later on, when he fools Jacob, he says it's not in the way of this place that we give the younger daughter before the older. So there it tells you something about the customs of the place. Without that, it seems to be that the repetition over here is to catch our attention. So these were the two problems that struck me. And, you know, again, keeping Shia's question in mind, so, again, just to be clear, we understand very well that once Rivka sees the way Isaac deals with the children once they're born, and she sees that his favor is the wrong one, so then she has the right to make decisions about omitting Isaac from considerations that he's oblivious to, or somewhat ignorant of. But until she had the children, so why did she not go to her own husband? There was no reason to leave him out and to go to other prophets to get information about a pregnancy. He was also a prophet. So what I want to suggest is that these two verses answer that. So take a look and see if you can tell me how it answers it. Now I've set it up that way. You see,
so Marshall.
Yes.
Do you think she was married before, and that maybe she had one pregnancy from one person and one pregnancy from the next?
No.
Okay.
You mean Rivka's two children?
Right.
No, it says openly that they were twins. They were twins.
You know, maternal twins or paternal twins, so.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'm just answering your question, that they weren't from two different mothers.
No, not from two different fathers, okay. Just a thought.
No, it couldn't be two different fathers either. So, like I say like this, that these two verses are giving you information that really caused Rivka to avoid Isaac in terms of the pregnancy, because this came before it. Now, what are these verses telling you? The verse is telling you, again, the first verse tells you that these are generations of Isaac, son of Abraham. But at the time that Abraham bore Isaac, so you just told me that Isaac is the son of Abraham. Right. But it's not telling you that. It's telling you that he bore him. Now, you know that a man can't give birth to a child. So it must mean something else. And what it would seem to me is using that type of intimate relationship of giving birth, it's ascribing it to Abraham to tell you that what Abraham did with Yitzchak, with Isaac, was like bearing him. I mean, although he didn't give birth to him, but he did everything aside from that, which is raising him. a very intimate relationship that Abraham had with Yitzhak, with Isaac. And this type of relationship really reflects on Isaac, that he needed it. And what's the proof? The proof is that who picked the wife for Isaac? His father did. His father sent Eliezer to go get a wife for him. Evidently, Isaac was not fit to do it himself. Okay, so you see that that really bears out the term over here of him bearing Isaac. That there was that type of relationship. So it's telling you a bit about Isaac. Now, let's switch over to the next verse. The next verse is telling you about who? It's telling you that Isaac took Rivka, but who was Rivka? Now Rivka is being explained to you. And I looked in the Or HaChaim, it's one of the commentaries, and he says the word Arami here does not mean a place. He says it really is hinting at, if you switch two letters, Aramean really means... Aramean is really Ramai, which means that it's a tricky person, a liar, a swindler. Oh, it's a swindler. So, you go back into the verse, you see it's not telling you that Isaac took Rivka, who was the daughter of Bethuel, who was a swindler, a liar, from the town of Padanaram, who also, and she was also the brother of Lavan, who was a liar, who you see clearly tricked Jacob many times. So now it's giving you information about Rivka, that she came from a house of people who were very shrewd. Now you put these two verses together, you realize that there was an Isaac who needed extra attention from Abraham, whatever it was, not that he was intellectually impaired, but whatever took place, that he was going to sacrifice himself on the altar when God commanded Abraham to kill him, that was a very big trial for Isaac himself. And it refers there, the rabbis refer to the fact there was a change in him. And then how did he become blind? Because the tears of the angels, when they saw this, fell into Isaac's eyes, which means, not literal, of course, because angels are not physical, but it's to tell you that there was some change in Isaac, and that he was raised to some level, some perfection. And perhaps this removed him a bit from the physical world. And therefore his assessment of things was more in a higher plane and not so in terms of the interpersonal workings of people. But in stark contrast, Rivka came from a house where that was the focus. Her father and her brother were shrewd people. They knew how to calculate people, how to second guess people, how to trick people. And she saw this. She wasn't this way, of course. But she saw this and she learned it. And you see that she was able to apply that when necessary in terms of, you know, stealing the birthright for her son. But now that you see that the two verses in the beginning are giving you information in terms of the type of people that Isaac were and Rivka, now we can answer Shai's question, which was how did Rivka know to omit Isaac about her pregnancy? The answer is right here now. Because she understood who Isaac was and that he was not in the same sphere of understanding or appreciation of interpersonal issues. And her pregnancy was about interpersonal. She saw that there was difference in the two children. Like the rabbis say, a metaphor, that when she was pregnant, and she would pass by a house of idol worship, so Esav tried to get out of her stomach. And when she passed by a house of studies, so Jacob tried to get out. That's not literal, of course, because infants can't know what's going on in the outside world. So it's a metaphor. But it means she understood that there were two opposing natures over here. And when it comes to that, she realized that this is not an issue that Isaac could be involved in. That's why she omitted him, even before, because she knew she was pregnant, so the matter was about personal relationships. She saw there was something different, that these two infants and her stomach were at each other. So now she knew that understanding her husband and also being shrewd herself, she realized that she had to avoid him. He was not one that she can go to on this. And maybe even from the start, not only not to go, but to not to have not to, that he should not be involved at all. So she was cautious, and she went to some other prophets to find out what was going on. And then she always kept it a secret, rightfully so. And the proof that you see that she was right about it is that when she actually arranges the whole scheme, and she dresses up Jacob with the goat skins on his neck and on his arms, so this way his father would feel him, he would feel like his very hairy brother Esav. So you see that as soon as he finished getting the blessing, the Torah tells you, it wasn't as soon as Jacob left the tent of Isaac that Esav walked in the other side. He walked in, it doesn't say the other side, but it has to be from a direction that he could not have seen Jacob leaving. So it seemed to be that, you know, Jacob was walking away in one direction, Esav was approaching it the other direction. And the Torah is telling you this to tell you that God orchestrated this, that he condoned exactly what Rivka did, and the prophecy was for this very reason to begin with. So you see now how it answers Shai's question. That's how she knew even before having the children, because the Torah is telling you she understood just the differences between her nature and her husband's nature. And she knew where he had to be omitted in terms of what issues. All right, so let me stop here and see if you have any questions.
I also thought that maybe because she was a very kind person, so she knew that there was going to be something, some conflict, some the kids weren't going to get along, so she didn't want Isaac to know about it. She didn't want to give him any pain.
I would say that may be parenthetical. I mean, I think the real information was what she got in terms of prophecy. And, I hear what you're saying, that she saw that there was some sort of a rivalry going on even before they were born.
And I think it would hurt any parent to know that there's something maybe possibly wrong with their children, you know what it was, because I don't feel like even if Spencer Isaac couldn't deal with, couldn't understand what was going on, I don't see, like, why would she just tell him, like, how would she know that telling him would cause harm or anything?
Well, telling him would involve his decisions in the matter, and then that was not going to be fruitful because she knew that he couldn't have all the facts. He just didn't have that level of assessment. There was something that he was not grasping. Partially, I'm sure, in terms of whatever happened at the sacrifice, or I'm not sure at what point he became blind.
I see, that makes a lot of sense, I think, now that I think about it.
The question is whether Shia likes my answer, though.
I'll tell him.
But it was very good. I mean, it was a very good, really good question. But you see, I mean, according to what I'm saying, that the Torah is not without an answer. And you see now that, because these verses in the beginning are odd. But now you can appreciate the reason why they're placed here. Doug, Cal?
I see the point, Rabbi. It's interesting. I mean, they have a very different kind of marriage relationship, but I also can see how that can come about because they didn't exactly sit down and, you know, date and decide they were right for each other. It was completely arranged sight unseen. Right. So I can see where she might perceive, okay, for lack of a better term, I don't know if you call them character flaws in Isaac, but maybe deficiencies.
Right.
And would take steps to deal with that in whatever way she thought was best.
Well, again, I think the information she was given the imperative, not just because, again, the prophecy itself didn't impose any imperative on her, any obligation for her to act. Like I said, there were many other prophecies that it was just informative. It didn't require the prophet to do anything. He was being informed of something. The knowledge was the objective. Here, the information was given to her, but then there was a separate act of the hand of Jacob grasping onto Esav's heel. Now she wondered, what's that for? Why is that happening? This also, she knew how to understand that there's a message over here. So she knew I'm being shown this nature in order that I should understand that I have to work on it. I have to harness this knowledge and utilize it in terms of, because it's directly connected with that prophecy that I received.
I think last week we touched upon the fact that the house that she was raised in and what she was exposed to, she understood the nature. But I don't think that we went into the verses like you're doing here, and that's what I'm finding very interesting.
Well, the verses we did last week were, we itemized all the issues. Like, why does she have to have a prophecy? And why was Jacob's hand on the heel? And how Jacob was so ready to ask Esav at a moment's notice for the birthright, and the whole deception, and why it tells us that she loved Jacob and that Esav and was loved by Isaac. Oh, that's what we had gone back to the verses last week too, and we said that these pieces of information, it really opened up the whole story. So it's really the verses are really, it's just an amazing science, you know, in terms of, it just takes years of going through it and then having proper training and then developing an ear that can be sensitive to, you know, how we're being taught and what's necessary here, what's not necessary, and having the level of appreciation. Like I started saying at the beginning, that if you really, like King Solomon says in Proverbs, right in the beginning, he says, if you seek it out like silver, and you dig for it like gold, then you'll understand the knowledge of God. So that means that if it's something that the more you penetrate, the more you find. So, you know, the questions, of course, have to be, you know, intelligent questions. You don't just ask any question, but the questions have to be on the apparent problems in each verse and in the nature of the story as a whole. And as you go through it, you start seeing things that are redundant, unnecessary. And this week with the ladder also, the whole story with the vision of the ladder is very, very interesting. And just using this very approach, new questions arose that, again, I had never seen before, and I had looked at that, you know, many, many times, and you start raising new questions, and you start being sensitive to nuances that you really need to take, because whenever you're going through an area and you're studying, so typically you start focusing on something and then you start exploring in that angle and then you exhaust it and you're satisfied with it and you move on. Next year you come around, the next time you come around, now that you've closed the book in that area, you may see a different nuance in some other verse and it's on a completely different track, which you didn't see the first time because your focus was caught. You were blinded by the headlights, so to speak, in terms of one area last year. And that propelled you to investigate that area. So your mind is thinking along those lines, so it's not looking at necessarily something which doesn't fit in with that area. So here, like for example, this year we're looking at this whole story in terms of the interpersonal relationship between Isaac and Rivka and how it played out in terms of the sons. Those very same verses can have a whole, you know, a slew of other stories going on, but we are not on that track right now, so we're not really looking for that. Next year we may come back to this and see a whole different thing, a whole different area in terms of some other concept. But that's, again, it's coming from God's wisdom, so that's why there can be so many ideas woven into, you know, the same verses. So we have to have that level of appreciation. That's what King Solomon says. If you dig for it like silver and seek it out like, how's he say it? If you search it out like silver and like buried treasure, you run after it. I mean, the knowledge, if you're going after knowledge of God in that way, then you'll understand knowledge of God, because it's not on the surface. You have to dig for it. And it is very subtle clues. And the reasoning after that, King Solomon says, why is it that way? That it's a process where you must dig for it and chase after it like a buried treasure. Number one, it's telling you, if your attitude is such that you understand the Torah to be like a treasure, that it's something here that's fantastic, that's unparalleled, it's priceless. If that's your attitude, then you will search after it and you'll respond to it that way, and you'll seek after it with that type of a yearning, a longing, to see what else can I find here, then you'll understand the deeper concepts. But he explains why. He says, because God gives forth wisdom, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. Two things. Because one thing is that God, Ki Hashem Yitein Chachma, God gives forth wisdom. This is now the explanation why you have to study with an attitude like you're digging for a buried treasure. Why? Because, number one, Ki Hashem Yitein Chachma, God gives forth wisdom. Number two, Mipiv Das Usuna, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. So what are these two messages? Number one, that it, the reasoning is because, number one, it's God giving the wisdom. And number two, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. What are those two messages there? We can apply the very lesson of that verse to itself. There's two things he's saying here. He's saying you have to have that attitude of looking, of searching and running after Torah ideas like it's a buried treasure, like it's silver. And then if you do that, then you'll understand God's knowledge. And the reasoning, number one, it's because it's God that created this, that formulated the Torah. So now that I know the source of the Torah, that's what will give me the energy to go after it and not be satisfied with simplistic answers. I know that it's God who created the heavens and earth. So when he gives a verse over through the prophets and like King Solomon, and he writes it down, so there must be, I have to understand, this is really God's knowledge. So that's what's going to propel me into a vigorous study, and I will not be satisfied with simplistic answers. I'm looking for a real ruby over here. I'm looking for a precious diamond. But I know where the knowledge is coming from. The source is God that gives knowledge. But what's the second part of that verse? It says, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding. What is that telling you? It sounds redundant, doesn't it? You just told me that what will propel you into great study is when you realize the source is God, because it's God that's giving forth knowledge. God gives forth wisdom. So what more are you telling me when you say, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding? What more is that telling me? What's the key word there?
Like the key word.
What's that?
Like the key word is mouth.
Exactly. That's the new idea that's introduced here. So what could, God doesn't have a mouth. So what could this possibly mean?
Like a prophet? Would a prophet be called like his mouth?
Well, if you've already told me that at the beginning of the verse that the source of knowledge is God, so right, you're not going to add anything by saying this coming through a prophet. The way he says it. Very good. Does that know me?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mipiv means the articulated word. See, one thing to propel a person into study is to understand who is the source of all this knowledge. It's God. That's the first part of the verse. Because God gives forth knowledge. But when it says, Mipiv, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding, it's not telling you that the articulated verses is what you must look at. So one thing that propels me in study is understanding the source of this knowledge in the Torah is God. But now I'm being told that from what he articulates, the formulations of the very verses is something to pay attention to. Equally as important. And those are really the keys to opening up the area. Again, being sensitive to the words, like Rabbi Tate would say. Let the words speak to you. Just go through the verses and start saying what's problematic here. The Torah is written in the way where it will train the Torah student if he has that right attitude. He's not trying to just brush off with simplistic answers. A person wouldn't answer Einstein that way. Einstein asked him for a formulation for relativity, whatever it is. So a person won't just give, there's gravity and there's this and that and that's it. No. They know that will not be something that Einstein will find satisfying. So that's human knowledge. So certainly, when you have in your hands a book that God told Moses and he wrote it down word for word, now. There has to be a great sensitivity to what you're reading here. Many times, you know, people do a very big disservice by giving very simplistic things, and they don't go back to the verse. I rarely hear where a person's giving over a lecture, and they're showing how the verses themselves reveal the concepts of the teaching. You really have to show. It's called the Chachmas HaKasav, the wisdom of the written word. That's really where the person's mind will get trained. They'll start having a higher appreciation for God because they'll see, wow, look how this is written in such a precise fashion with these clues, and the very words that raise the question give the answer too, that the rabbis say. They say the response is right next to the question. Alright, it's clear?
Yes, it is.
Right. Okay. The JHS online is asking, I'm not sure if you're asking us, if you want to spell that out. You're asking me about a memra? I'm not sure. Okay. Right, any questions, any comments?
I think we're good.
Yep, makes sense.
Okay, that was really all I wanted to address. I know we have like a few more minutes here, so maybe we want to use the time if anybody has a question in general, or we can take that up now. We haven't done that in a while anyway.
Well, I've got one.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember how it came up, but at Rosh Hashanah time, everybody is written in the Book of Life or in the Book of Death, eventually between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Right.
Yet we say that a person is under the random, if you will, laws of nature. Now, if a person was written in the Book of Death, then theoretically God, as I understand it, God decreed that person should die. So if that's true, then they're not really under the random laws of nature, because it's already been decreed that they should die.
Why can't it be both? Why can't it be that we don't know exactly when they're going to die? I know that Maimonides says that the person's his sins outweigh his righteousness. Immediately he dies. Let me see here where that source is. That would seem to imply that everybody's dying between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is worthy of being killed. But you don't see that. Let's see. Yeah, it's in the Laws of Repentance, Chapter 3, right at the beginning. Laws of Repentance, Chapter 3, right at the beginning. It says, every human being has merits and sins. Right? Everybody sins and everybody does merits. A person whose merits are greater than his sins is righteous. He's called a tzaddik. Alright? And a person whose sins are greater than his merits is called a wicked person, a rasha. A person's half and half is called a in-between. And so also does this work on a larger, the macro level, in terms of cities. If the city has more merits for the dwellers than their sins, it's tzidkas, it's a righteous city. And conversely, if their sins are greater, it's a wicked city, like Sodom and Amara. And so also the whole world. So there's three levels, individuals, cities, and the entire earth. Law 2, he says, a person whose sins are greater than his merits, immediately he dies in his wickedness. As it states, because of the multitude of his sins. And also a city whose sins are greater, it's immediately destroyed. As he cites, Sodom and Amorah. right? This is the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and God wiped them out, and also the entire world too. All right, you see that by when?
By Noah.
God wiped out the world. And again, he says, immediately it is destroyed. But you see that he gave 120 years for Noah to build the ark after he saw that the earth was not worthy. So there, I believe Rashi is the one that says, to give them opportunity to repent. So you see, God still has mercy on his creations. And he also says an important point, this balance between the greater or the lesser amount of sins on individual cities of the earth is not in the number. It's not the it's not because of the count. It's not that I did 99 mitzvahs and I did one sin. No, it has to do with the gravity of each. So if I, you know, I run around and do good things all day long, but I killed a person, that could outweigh. And King Solomon says it too, that some evil can outweigh much good. And he also says there are some merits that are outweigh many sins. And he quotes a verse there, on account that there was something good found in this person. And there are some sins that outweigh many merits. Here's the quote. He says, one sin destroys much good. And he says an important lesson at the end. He says, and nobody can estimate, can assess this balance except for God, the one who knows the thoughts of man. He knows how to measure the merits against the sins. So when does a person die immediately? That is when the sins outweigh the good. Okay? He talks more, if you go through it. He says, anybody who regrets a mitzvah that he did, he is sorry about it, on his merits, and he says, what good did it do for me when I did these commands? He says, it would have been better that I didn't do them. So this person, he destroys all of his merits. And that one merit is remembered that he did in the world. And like it says, the righteousness of the righteous person will not save him on the day of his evil. So the day of his evil means when he laments over all the good that he did. Oh, look at all the time I wasted. I could have been doing something else instead of following the Torah. So that, the person, if he really feels that way, he loses all of his merits.
Okay, but we also see in Sodom and Gomorrah that if there were, say, seven righteous people there, they would have been swept away, even though they were righteous.
No, they'll be saved. Abraham and Lot were saved.
Abraham had the discussion with God, and they got down to 10, and that's when Abraham stopped. And so my understanding is we learned that below that number,
he wouldn't save the cities. But I don't think he's gonna. He's not gonna. No, for sure, God would not destroy a totally righteous person.
But I thought I've understood Rabbi Shade to teach that if a society gets swept up or there's a tsunami or whatever, the tsunami doesn't differentiate between the righteous man on the beach and the wicked man on the beach.
But look,
we're all subject to the laws of nature.
But the very story tells you that the opposite, that Lot, who did live there, was saved.
So you would hold that a righteous person will always be saved from a natural or a man-made catastrophe?
Yeah, that's God's exact justice. If a person is not worthy of any, he did not do any sin, so then there's no reason that he should be punished?
So if a righteous...
Well,
may I explain the general question of when the righteous die along with the good? Does that suggest that of the 6 million people who died in the Holocaust, not a single one was righteous?
Many people didn't get killed. You've hundreds and hundreds of European Jews that started new lives here. It's beyond our comprehension how certain people, you know, why were they selected? Was it an accident? No, I mean, God's workings are beyond our thinking, but you have to go with the principle that God is just. And again, you see that Lot was saved. Noah and his family were saved. If you tell me that there's a natural nature of things, so what's the difference with I mean, let's think out loud here. There are plenty of cases where the righteous were thrown into Daniel's three friends, Mishael, Azariah, and Hananiah. They were thrown into a fiery furnace, and the fire didn't touch them. Daniel was in a den of lions that didn't touch him.
I understand those cases, and yet are you going to extrapolate that then to all of history and say that a righteous person has never been killed by circumstances?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think you can. I think it's too complicated to really know.
Well, I'll quote King David. He says that seven evils will befall the righteous, but he's saved from all of them.
So what would you do about the recent situation in Mumbai around that?
Anybody who did not sin, God is not going to afflict him.
Well, wait a second. I mean, everybody sins. There is no person in history without sin. If we're going to define righteous to be absolutely without sinning, I mean, we've excluded the entire human population, haven't we?
The other thing you're going to do is then say that God will kill somebody for no reason. You can't say
but God started, I mean, God gave man free will too, and so if a bunch of terrorists burst into a place, and I happen to be in that place,
right,
and we say, well, gee, God did that to me, I would think not, that would be man's responsibility.
Right, again, plenty of people did not die in the Holocaust, plenty of people, an extraordinary number of people were spared from the Twin Towers. I mean, that had a capacity. It was a Monday morning. It was like after, it was 9:30 or so, 9:10, 9:30, and there were only 3,000 people. Those buildings had a capacity of 50,000 workers. So that I find extraordinary. And again, you have to keep in mind too that in terms of how God assesses where He meets out punishment and reward, we don't know. So you could have somebody that, you know, you have, let's say, two people. So and both people sin. One person who sinned, he gets spared from a calamity. Another person who did the same or some other sin, he ends up being wiped away with evil. So how God measures out when and where a person gets punished for whatever they did in life is such an extraordinary science, you can't begin to start assessing it. It's only like Maimonides says here. So why did one person die young, another person live very, very old? That's God's equation in terms of how He meets out. Should they get some punishment here, a lot of punishment here? What was the level of punishment they needed to have? But the principle is, like King David says, and that you see in those different cases, where people who are really deserving were spared. Look what happened by whatchamacallit? Well, again, you'll tell me it's a miracle, but I was going to say by the Red Sea. There wasn't one Egyptian left over, and not one Jew was hurt. So there you say it's a miracle, so you can't really use that. So what about in a natural case? Well, we see a natural event like tsunamis, but we don't know what else is going on. You can't violate the principle that God is incapable of working out with precise accuracy that whoever is not worthy, they're living like, you know, fools. Like King David says, the people of the world that have wrong ideas about God, meaning they have no idea about God, so he equates them to animals. Why? Because animals, there's no providence over the individual animal. Over the species, yes, there is some providence. Because the species, he said, is something in our minds. It's a concept. Right? When we look at animals, all we see is individual animals. We don't see species. Species is an idea that we perceive. Oh, these are all the same type. They are part of the same species. Being that a species is an ideational, right? It lives in the world of metaphysics. That's something that the providence relates to. The individual animal, however, there's no intelligence in an animal, so there's not any providence over an individual animal. Maimonides says that God is not willing that this lion should eat this deer. No, but there is a will that how the species operates. So when people are so degraded and have no worth because they have no concept of God, they're just living their lives, eating and drinking and whatever, and making a living, but their lives are not serving a purpose of gaining wisdom. So then King David equates them to animals. Now there's no providence over that individual or this individual. So they can just suffer. But if a person is living properly and he's on a higher level, so then he's not up to the natural course of nature. Now there's a level of providence over that individual based on his level of perfection. And Maimonides goes in and talks about it. If you look at the patriarchs and the matriarchs, you see how the higher level the person, the more the Torah says God was involved in him. The lower level, so the lesser involvement. There was a story about another person who was thrown into a furnace, and he didn't come out unsinged. There was some sense of smoke in his clothing. So I think we talked about this last week, because here he had some sin. I think it was with his children. So there was some flaw that he had. Therefore, he wasn't completely oblivious to the effects of the flames. They had some, but he wasn't burnt. It still was a miracle. But by Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who were completely righteous, it says not only weren't they burnt, but there was no smell of smoke in them either. There was no effect whatsoever. There was a higher level. So you see how God works in degrees, exact degrees, that are based on the person's level. Yeah, it's an amazing thing. 6 million people. But that means that's to us. How would we work it out that these would just be people that had deserving and the other ones weren't? I mean, to me, you know, as a human being, how would you work it out? It's impossible to think about because it's God's way of doing it. But nothing is beyond God's ability. And again, we have to look at the facts. The facts are Noah was saved, and Lot was saved, and Mishael, Hananiah, and Azariah were saved. In all the other cases, and yes, some cases there are miracles, and then there's cases where there's nature, so we don't have all the facts. And we have to say we don't know. But we do know the principle. Tzadik Hashem b'chol derechav. God is righteous in all his ways. We say it in Ashrei 3 times a day. In all of his ways. There's nothing outside of it. Nothing is too insurmountable for him to address and to mete out real justice. How he does it, you see somebody who seems righteous, but then there's something that happens to him. Even the Talmud talks about this in many places. I'll see if I can locate it. I remember doing recently where it talks about how certain righteous would be punished when even though they didn't do anything wrong. But the Talmud says, no, they could have done something. But they could have taught people. There was something that was missing over there. It talks about the, I'm trying to remember where it is. But it clearly takes up this point. And it does not, and it also says that the sin, it says there's no sin or there's no punishment without some wrong that the person did.
So that would suggest then that as long as I keep mitzvot and do righteous acts, it doesn't really matter whether I pay attention to what's going on in the world around me.
No, a person can't just put himself in harm's way. That's a sin. That would also be a sin. If a sin is not just a person violating a command. It's if he doesn't use everything in his capability to, you know, the Torah also says you have to guard your souls. Mishmartim esnasher seichem. You don't just put yourself out and rely on miracles. That's a philosophical, a great philosophical error. But if a person is absolutely righteous without sin, so then he is not deserving of a punishment.
But no one is completely righteous without sin. So we're all, if I can generalize, maybe there's somebody out there, but,
yeah, but
even Moshe sinned.
Right, but there's sins there that are sins that are worthy of you being killed for, and then the sins of the not. Like, for example, I don't know if it's true or not, but if a person steals one penny, he wasn't really careful about something. So, does that mean that he's going to get swept away in a tsunami? that God's not going to allow him to live out his life, that sounds like it's a great imbalance. But if a person, you know, killed a few people in life, or killed one person in life, right, now I can see why, you know, measure for measure, he did something very grave, and he does not deserve. And then you have the level where a person is so egregious in the sins that God doesn't even allow them to repent. That they, therefore, they should die in their sin, like Paro, right, in two other cases. Think of Sichon and one other group of people. Yeah, it's hard for us to calculate how. It's not, that's why Maimonides says over here, that's God's one, he's the only one, right? That's 3:2 in the laws of repentance. He says, excuse me, 3:2 at the end. And we cannot assess, we cannot weigh, except with the knowledge of the one who knows the thoughts of man, who he knows how to assess the merits and the demerits. And he says it's not by the number of sins, it's by the gravity. And I'll tell you this also, one person who does the same sin as somebody else, that could also be different in terms of, you know, what the person is at, what level in life. You have a young boy who just turned 13, and then you've got a man who's 60. So there's a difference in terms of what degree of culpability there is, even for the same exact, you know, action. One is more responsible. He should have known better. There's many facets to it.
I was wondering why King Solomon prayed that when a Gentile prays in the Beit HaMikdash, he should always be answered, because it seems like God would already know, would already make those calculations.
Yeah, but a person is so if a person's sick, I shouldn't pray for them. God made the calculation already. No, as a human being, you have to function in the way you work, and you ask for your needs. God knows my needs too, so I don't have to pray. No, you have to demonstrate your convictions in action. That's what the whole idea is behind a system of laws, of mitzvahs. A person can have intellectual clarity on a certain point, but the way we are designed is that we do not demonstrate true conviction unless we act on it. If I think that a certain act is to be charitable, I think it's a great thing, but you never see me give a penny in my life, you question how convinced I am about charity, right? Because you understand this point, that the real conviction comes. Look at all the people that responded. There's this child that needs this treatment, and people came out in big numbers, and they gave, and because they see that this is necessary. I mean, God can heal the child, right? No, we live in a way where we demonstrate, and what God does, God does. But we still have to follow our minds and our convictions and what's true. So when King Solomon, I don't know, I think we spoke about this, there's a beautiful point over there. When he prayed that God should answer whatever the Gentiles ask for. So this is because he understands that when the Gentiles first coming in contact with the Torah system, he's still working with a sense of value that is on a lower level than the Jew who's been trained his whole life. So what is a Gentile's sense of value? That I have physical needs, let's say. So King Solomon wanted that whenever the Gentiles who now saw this temple and they knew about the one God who's the creator and that had the right idea of God, King Solomon wanted to have equality for both the Gentile and the Jew, because we are the exact same creation. But he said there's a different starting point. The Gentile doesn't have a real understanding of what the good is in life yet when he's first starting out. So he says to God, please grant them whatever they wish, because if you don't, then their sense of value is going to be, well, I prayed for this and God didn't give it to me, so what type of a system is that? So King Solomon said to God, no, give them whatever they want, whatever they ask. This way, they're imbued with, on their starting level, they're imbued with a sense of appreciation that this is the God that can do it. Because if they prayed to God and they didn't get anything, even if we're foolish, give me $1,000 in gold. So if they didn't get that, they would now equate God as being like any of the other idols that they asked for and they never got anything. So King Solomon, though, wanted that since they made the start and they are praying, and he says, anybody prays to you at this house? That was a condition. They have to be praying to the right God, King Solomon said. But then respond to them, because this will now open their hearts and they'll start seeing there's a difference over here. That's essential. It's essential that they see that they can get a response from the God of the Jews and nobody else. Now they'll escalate in their knowledge as the Jews teach them. But why did you ask the question, Naomi? Let me go back to your...
Okay, first of all, there's a lot of things. It seems like there's a lot of individual variations, first of all, because you can have a Gentile who's on a very high level, and, you know, even, like, could be even higher level than a Jew.
Right.
And also, it seems like, you know, when a person prays, God makes those calculations anyways, because the person is approaching God, so it seems like God would grant somebody what they pray for to bring them to a higher level. It seems like, you know, God would do that, and God would know better than King Solomon how to work things out.
Okay, yeah. Agreed. I agree with you. How did this come into the conversation about the... I just want to see how this flows in. If there was something else you were trying to point you were making about the righteous being saved and the and so on. Do you recall what caused you to ask the question?
I was just thinking about it a long time ago, so I tried to work it into the conversation.
Right.
I don't know.
All right. Good. I just want to make sure I'm answering. I want to make sure that the points are covered. But like you said, you know, the Jew has no monopoly on righteousness, and we always go back to the proof that Ruth was selected as being the forerunner of King David, King Solomon, and the Messiah is coming from Ruth, right? She was born a Gentile.
Please note that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Okay, so, again, like that's the palpable question, Doug, that you asked, that you had 6 million people and nobody's really worthy of being saved. Again, we don't know what all the calculations were and who was getting a certain punishment here or who was not worthy of salvation at all and what every single case was. But again, we do know the facts. Many people did not die. And we do know that God saved Noah and his family and Lot and the Jews in Egypt. And, Rashi says that there were 4/5 of the Jews in Egypt were killed because they couldn't extricate themselves from the idolatry of Egypt. So, you know, the Torah doesn't gloss over this. Again, those were cases of miracles. Then there are natural events, too. So we see the natural event, but we don't know what God's doing behind the scenes in terms of who was prevented from getting there. You know, it's just, we have to say that it's all the facts show us, again, God is a fair God. He's behind justice. Where do we see him ever doing injustice? So if that's the case, all right, so we can't answer how he worked it out, but, you know, we see King David saying that, you know, what does it mean that seven hard matters or will befall the righteous person, but he'll be saved from all of them. So why did it even befall him? Right? Again, you have to study everything. So it's telling you, I believe, that what does it mean that they befall him but he's saved? I mean, he is living in a world. A righteous person is living in a world of people of free will. So people and their foolish schemes will commence things that can affect the righteous. But a person is completely deserving, so he'll be saved from them all. From all of them. That's the operative word there. V'yatzilenu mekulam. God will save him from all the catastrophes. So the principle is what we have to seize on to. We can't look at the cases and, you know, it's just outside of the human ability to calculate 6 million people. Every single, yeah, God can work it out. It's not a big thing for him. But that's what justice is all about. I mean, that's why a person should be so on guard to really understand the damage of sin and and to stay away from it, and to be true, and to learn, and to increase his knowledge in these areas. So, in terms of your original question, Doug, so if you're telling me that everybody is written in the book, right? So you see that the, so how is it that a person can be under the laws of nature if he's like, you know, a completely ignorant person, so he's not deserving of God's providence, so then he's just going to be like an animal, like King David says, he's going to be completely under the laws of nature, all right? So is that a third category, where he's not deserving of immediate death, but he's in between, and he doesn't really change? Or that he's not deserving of death, but if he doesn't do anything, so then he's not going to be saved from calamity. We have to study that. Maybe we'll do that as a for this coming week. I'd be interested in going through it myself, like looking at the different Talmudic sources, going through the stories, going through this. So maybe we should do this for next week. Look at chapter 3 in the laws of repentance. Look either before that and afterwards as well, to see where how much he continues with this theme of how it is that God meets out justice. You know, if there's any stories that come to mind in terms of the Torah, so go into that as well. And I would definitely appreciate it if, as you're all going through it this week, you know, email me. This way, there's sources I'm sure I'm going to overlook. Or there may be other questions that come up. So let's do this as not wait till next week to start approaching this, but as you know, the questions come up, or as you find answers or clues or different topics, and email them to me so I can look at it. We can work throughout the week on this. So we'll make it a daily project, you know, until Sunday. So hopefully by Sunday we'll have conversed a lot during the week.
Your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
But so by next Sunday, we'll have, you know, together discussed it back and forth, email, the phone, whatever's good for you. So let's take this up. It's important. I mean, it's important that we have a real appreciation. Take a look also at Ezekiel chapter 18. I remember once studying at Beth Shalom, and I asked the rabbi there, Rabbi Hain, about a source. He had mentioned it to me, and it was a very useful source in terms of righteousness and sin. All right, so we have a work cut out for us. Let's take this. Let's see how far we can get with it. Really, it looks like you really have to go through the beginning of the laws of repentance. How many chapters is it? It's not too big. You can probably go through the whole thing. So it doesn't mean necessarily we'll complete it all by Sunday, but at least let's start working on it as of today, all right? And we'll take this as next week's topic. Yeah, God's justice. As far as, you know, we can approach in 1 week of study. Maybe we'll do them more than just 1 week now. And you see, he talks about different things. You sin against your friend. You don't ask him for forgiveness. I mean, there's many parts of sin. A person has a thought. Is it considered like he actually did it or not? All right. All right. We're ready? We're all set. So we'll discuss this throughout. I mean, today, tomorrow, the rest of the week, all right?
All right.
So as the questions come up and as you find sources, let's stay in touch and, you know, let's do a, I guess we could do a group email on this, right? So when you write, so, you know, respond to everybody in the group. So I guess we'll start with one or two people emailing. We'll respond and put anybody else on your list. If you know what, if you want, send, everybody should send an email now. Send it to, which one would be an email that's not used so much, so I can see them all. You send it to rabbi@masorah.org. Just send, you know, an email and just put the topic, you know, God's justice. I'll put everybody's email onto one email and I'll respond. So now we'll have one initial email and everybody could be on it. And then when we respond, everybody should respond to each other. That's one way we can do it. Another way we can do it is maybe on the, we could do is, you know, it's maybe a better idea to involve more people. Let's use the discussion board. I'll start a new thing in the discussions forum on the Masora site. So if you go to the discussion forum, I'll set up something new. Send me the email anyway. Everybody send me the email at rabbi@masora.org. This way I'll tell you exactly the link to go to once I set it up. So when I get off now, I'll set up. We'll have a new forum. We'll use that. And this way we can all post our comments and we can read what everybody else said without, we can just go right to the forum. How's that sound? That's better?
That should work.
Okay. All right, so I'll set that up in the few. All right, good. Thanks for the question, Doug. This really is a... this will be a very busy week.
No, it's my son's question.
Oh, good.
Give credit to him.
Yeah, tell him thanks.
Okay. All right, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Okay, everybody will speak soon. Send the emails now. I'll send you back a link. I'll set up something shortly. And we'll speak soon.
Okay, Rabbi. Have a great week. Thanks.
Okay, everybody. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so that will wrap it up for today. In case anybody came in late, so what we're going to do is take up this topic of God's justice. That was Doug Taylor's son's question, and let's go with it and stay as far as we can on it. If you want, you can send an email in to rabbi@masora.org, and we'll just put you on the list of this group, and everybody will know about you know where to go to on the discussions forum. Okay, and we'll do this throughout the week. So this will be a work in progress this week. We're not going to wait until next Sunday. And we'll just go day by day. All right, so everybody, I look forward to getting emails. I'll put you on that list. And as soon as today, I think we would start working on it. Okay, Mike, JHS, Helen, everybody have a good day, good week, and we'll speak to you soon. And send the emails in. Okay, anybody who's listening to the class, once we put it online, again, feel free to join in on this discussion that we'll start doing throughout this week.